Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive, and the world is turning inside out. Yeah, I'm floating around in ecstasy, so don't stop me now.
That was the wonderful Courtney Freed singing Don't Stop Me Now. She's created a new show, Don't Stop Me Now, The Freddie Mercury Experience, and it's going to run at Coho Theater April 4th through the 8th. You can find out more and get tickets at liveonstage.us. And now a deep dive and a deep breath with Maureen Porter of Third Rail Repertory Theater. Hey, everybody, I'm Susanna Mars, and welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. We are in a tiny, tiny booth at Artist Repertory Theater, and I'm with Maureen Porter from Third Rail Rep. We're going to talk about some cool stuff going on there. Hey, Maureen, thanks for coming.
Thank you so much, Susanna. I'm really happy to be here, even in this tiny, tiny room.
Tiny, tiny room. There's a lot of cool stuff going up at Third Rail, and one thing that I love and I wanted to talk about a little bit is this NT Live. Can you describe to everyone a little bit about what NT Live is?
Absolutely. So NT Live is the National Theatre in London's program where they live capture performances there and broadcast them to cinemas and theatres around Portland.
And they're live.
I mean, around the world. Mm-hmm. And they're live. They're captured live. And you can actually broadcast them live as well if you're in the correct time zone. Mm-hmm. We often are in a not great time zone for that, but we have actually done a few live streams, which is really fun.
Oh, I bet.
Right? Because you're really there, in a sense, with the audience and watching it happen, unfold.
I saw One Man, Two Governors. Oh, my gosh, I loved being able to see that production. That was really fun.
So brilliant. And actually, one of the programs coming up, Young Marx, which is starring Rory Kinnear as the young Karl Marx and directed by Nicholas Heitner, is the brainchild of the same creative team that did One Man, Two Governors.
Oh, interesting. And it's a lot of fun, I think, especially for artists to see these NT Live productions, because you really get an infusion of inspiration from a whole other place and different creatives, and it's really exciting.
I think it's really true. There is a way in which the National Theatre is such a remarkable place in that it produces shows of all sizes in its various theaters, and we bring quite a bit of it to Portland, and so you have access to really phenomenal performances of all kinds, and contemporary work as well as classical work. I mean, it varies. So there's an enormous amount. And the camera does a fascinating thing because, of course, these are staged at the National Theatre in London. But the camera does a thing where it brings you into the performers in a really intimate way, in a way that only the camera can do. Mm-hmm. We've had fun a couple times when we go to London each year for a tour in London, and we've had the opportunity to see some of the plays live, mm-hmm, and then come back and watch them broadcast.
Oh, that must be fun.
And to look at the way in which the two different mediums or experiences, what we learn, what we see differently. And, of course, the theater, you know, it's staged for a particular kind of focus, and the camera changes that. But then you suddenly get this close-up of some, you know, world-famous actor, you know, Helen Mirren, in a moment that is just, like, beautifully intricate that from the stage you don't quite, or from the audience when you're there, you don't, mm-hmm, quite get. Sometimes you miss a little bit of the full composition of the stage with the NT Live. You don't get to see the overall effect of the staging
in some ways, the breadth of it.
Yeah, but it's a marvelous program and really accessible, and they've been doing it well. You know, they've been doing it for years now, so it's
really
high quality.
Yeah.
They're a lot of fun.
And now you mentioned that you do trips for theater goers.
We do,
and you are ahead, you take people on trips, you talk about plays, you go to various locations. What was the last one like?
Well, the last one, it's interesting, we're just heading into the next one. Mm-hmm. But it's always marvelous. Scott Yarbrough, the founding artistic director of the company, curates really the plays that we see. That's where his passion and his love for theater was born. Mm. And so he's marvelous at choosing what we might like to look at. And we try to do a range of experimental things, a little bit of the West End, something at the National. And then we have conversations with artists who are playwrights, directors, designers while we're there. And we have conversations with the people who attend. And that group of people, they've become their own community in a way. They come back to Portland and they see theater together. They're an amazing group. We talk a lot about theater. Last night we had our welcome reception for the upcoming London tour.
When do you leave?
We leave April, April 20th, but that might be the wrong date. But it's closing, closing in on April.
And anybody can join this group.
Anybody can come, yes, it's an amazing, and it's fun. This year we have a mix of folks who have been before and brand new people, really different experiences. Last year we had a family that came with two college-aged students.
What fun.
Which was really amazing.
To have a curated trip by artists and to be able to engage in that way, it's really unique.
I think it is. And we don't do, we're going to go see Big Ben. Or, you know, we actually talk about the work. We eat a lot of great food, I'll say that too. Mm-hmm. But we just spend time in dialogue and in conversation about the work and comparing what each person thought and thinking about how that might enlighten or throw into relief your own experience. I mean, there's just so much to learn. It's an incredible tour.
What a wonderful way to combine the opportunity to see VNT live, to see theater live in London, and then, of course, to be a patron of Third Rail and see what you're bringing to the table. How do you think going to London on a regular basis impacts your choices at Third Rail?
Well, I think historically it's impacted them a great deal because, again, in large part, Scott's primary passion came from his early experiences at the National Theater. And so Third Rail has produced a lot of playwrights over the years from the UK, really great playwrights. And
I remember a lot of Enda Walsh. And
And we, right now, we're mixing that a little bit. We've really articulated clearly that we would like to be inclusive of more diverse playwrights and directors and designers, et cetera, and to bring that legacy along with us, but also to make sure that it remains inclusive. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, I mean, Alice Birch is a British playwright, and we're producing her play Revolt. Mm-hmm. She said Revolt again, but still a little bit different than the, than a lot of the great male white writers from the UK, but we need to break that open a little bit more.
Right, and you just mentioned that play that's coming up at Third Rail.
Yeah.
And it was described to me as a feminist manifesto and a bona fide pep rally.
Yes.
Which sounds fantastic.
It is fantastic. It's Revolt, She Said Revolt Again by Alice Birch, and Rebecca Lingefelter is directing it. And it is a real, definitely a feminist manifesto in that it looks at the construct of gender and what the meanings that get applied because of systematic, because of the systems we live in, how gender becomes a thing in order to keep people in a particular place. Mm. It's the same thing as race. It's these constructs, these social constructs that aren't empirically true, but they are utilized for, in many ways, and our identities are tied to those things. And they're defined a lot through language, the use of language. Mm. And Alice Birch deconstructs language over the course of the play in this really fascinating way. Mm. In the beginning, there are a series of scenes that are very recognizable to begin, but then she starts to pull them apart. And particularly in relationship to gender. Mm. And what happens when we try to deconstruct the language itself, what remains for us at the end of that? It's a fascinating, powerful intelligent piece. It feels classic Third Rail in many ways, in that it's, you know, it has an explosive quality to it. It's very funny. It's very dark. She's a marvelous playwright, and Rebecca Lingenfelter is a phenomenal director. Mm-hmm. So that is exciting. That's an exciting thing coming up next on our main stage that will end this season.
Who are your actors?
Roland Walsh, mm-hmm. Karen Trumbo, mm-hmm. I am in it, mm-hmm. Alex Ramirez, mm-hmm. and Andrea Whittle.
Oh, lovely.
So, yeah. It's this season we've had one of the things in this year that was important to me was gender parity as a primary focus. And so out of 19 roles on Third Rail stage this year, 16 were given to women, which is something that
that's
I feel
beyond parity.
Really strongly about. Yeah. Well, we have to, like, mm-hmm. sometimes we have to go further because mm-hmm. there's an enormous amount of disparity, obviously.
Right. And if it works, then that's fantastic, you know, and when
right.
you can do it, that's amazing.
It is wonderful. Our last production, Men on Boats, 10 women. 10 diverse women ranging in age, across lifespan, gender expression, sexual orientation, race. It's just been so marvelous to feel that is something new at Third Rail. That is something that we are consciously trying to break that open. And mm-hmm. it's, as I think everybody is, looking at these things as well we should be and need mm-hmm. to be. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to just, you know, you have to take a hammer and smash it, because it does less if we talk with good intention for a long time about the same things.
Right.
And I'm really aware in this last year in my position of how easy it is to make mistakes when you're trying to do this work. Mm-hmm. It's very humbling, mm-hmm. But it's also really exciting. And I think if you're willing to, you're willing to put yourself out there and
gotta
do
so
it wrong.
Vulnerable.
Yeah,
and
you really do.
Wrong and strong.
Yeah, yeah. And say when you're wrong, which, you know, is important.
Yep.
And then stay in the work.
Right.
So that's been an exciting, I think this last half of the season, it's been exciting to feel that, and in all its glorious imperfection, but also it's the way in which it's just opening energetically and creatively and artistically the potential for what we're doing going forward. That's mm-hmm. that's exciting.
What's new at Third Rail in terms of where you're going to be performing? I know that the next show's at Coho. I know that you don't have a space per se. What's that like in the city? There's been lots of news about how hard it is for performing arts organizations to find space.
Yeah, that's right. Susanna, thank you for asking that. It is like a challenge that is probably one of the greatest challenges we have in front of us is affordable and accessible performance space. And it's not just Third Rail, of course. Where we are right now for our office space is the Sunnyside Community Center in Southeast Portland. Mm-hmm. And right now, Third Rail is there. Suelu is there. Portland Experimental Theater Ensemble is there. Pete mm-hmm. and Boom Arts. All four of us are there. And what I love about that, four small arts organizations that intersect with a functioning community center. So the Sunnyside Community Center is owned by the Methodist Church, the United Methodist Church, and there is no congregation there, but there is still ministry going on. And so once a week, there is a dinner served for people facing the streets and homelessness. There are showers given twice a week to people in need who are on the streets. There is a school for kids down in the basement, and they also take the public school kids who don't get a ride at the end of the day to that space for a safe space before they're picked up. There's pickup basketball games in the basketball court upstairs.
Oh, that's
nice. There's so much happening in the center, and so that has been a real blessing. It feels very vibrant, and there's an enormous amount of generosity between the groups that are there.
Mm-hmm.
And I love this idea of the intersection between social service and arts. Mm-hmm. I love that our rent, the little bit of rent that we have to pay, goes to something as collaborative as that and as impactful potentially in multiple ways. we'll see what the history of that building is. We mm-hmm. There are many questions in the air. This coming season in 2018-19, we will be at Coho Theater for mm-hmm. the entire season.
Oh, that's great.
That'll offer us continuity, which is nice. Mm-hmm. And it's where we started, and our patrons know it well. And that helps us to be in one place and where we know we're going to be, that's familiar to us. And so.
And Coho is such a great space, too. It's intimate. It's beautiful. There's lots of wonderful places to eat. It's a great area.
It is. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And we're very happy to have that, have that be an option this year, which is great.
Right.
Yeah.
I have some funny questions for you. These are what I call the silly questions, but they're fun.
Okay.
What would you like to wake up to every morning?
Oh, what would I like to wake up? What came into my mind was a glass of red wine, but I'm not sure we really want to put that out on the podcast. I was like, oh, that's really nighttime, not so much morning. I do quite love waking up to my husband, so that's pretty good, but I have that.
What would you like to wake up to every morning?
Peace. Ease. Breath.
Those are three really good things. If you could pick any generation to grow up in, which would you choose?
Oh my gosh, that's challenging.
I know. I've had answers ranging from the Belle Epoque to the 70s, the Puritans. I mean, I know.
Wow. It's hard for me to imagine. With everything that's happening in the world right now, it could be easy to want to go someplace else mm-hmm. and live someplace else. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that there is no time that doesn't have
its issues.
This is the I feel like right now is the time. For all the things that we're up against, I feel like this is an amazing time to be alive. Mm-hmm. And it is a time where I identify the work that needs to be done, but also the work that is being done. And I mean, we actually have a pretty amazing life. Mm-hmm.
I really like your answer.
Do you?
Yeah, it's now.
I feel really unsure about it.
No, it's great. I mean, I think what you said is right on, and the work you're doing is speaking to what we're up against right now. So it's pretty great confluence of events for creative expressives, for creative artists.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of periods that I think about are places I think about, there's a romanticized version, I guess.
I agree with that. That's another part of now that's so exciting, is going back into those past eras and seeing a little more through the fog of men and romance and seeing the voices that haven't been heard, which really kind of take the whole shine off of certain eras.
Oh, my God. Absolutely.
Many.
Absolutely.
Most.
Yes. I mean,
all.
Like, there's so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's the third one. It's the last one.
I hope I do better.
You're doing great. If you knew it would be published, name someone alive or dead whose biography you would love to write. You would have full access to their life.
Well, there's so much written. The person whose name came into my head right now is James Baldwin. But there's so much written, his own writing, and I think that's because I was reading something of his earlier today. Mm. We were just reading about women in history, and there was the woman who prior to Amelia Earhart mm-hmm. took the first flight, but I can't remember her name.
Okay, I can Google it.
The woman who discovered the...
Bessie Coleman.
Yes, Bessie Coleman.
Bessie Coleman broke multiple barriers when she took flight in 1921 and became the first African-American woman to earn a pilot's license.
Yes.
The women pilots that history forgot. Harriet Quimby is another one.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Well, yeah, yes. And there's also someone else who I'm not remembering her name. This is the thing that's the porter. My mother, my sweet mother, mm-hmm. does this kind of thing all the time. I can feel my mother in me right now. You know how sometimes you're like, oh, my God, I am my mother.
Maybe you should do your biography
of my mother. Yes, yes. Actually, Geraldine Porter, I could easily do an amazing biography. And I actually would like to learn more about her life than I know. Like,
and you'll have, you'd have full access to her life.
I would have full access to her life, which would be fascinating.
Which would be. I never thought about that. When I've asked this question before, if you did someone in your own family, you would have full access to their life, therefore full access to your own life.
And is that something you, like,
want
what
to do.
Does that uncover?
Right.
There's a lot, right, that could uncover.
Right. Well, on that note, I want to thank you for coming. And it's been delightful talking to you.
Thank you, Susanna.
Everybody who's listening, you can go to thirdrailrep.org and check out everything we've been talking about. You can see NT Live. You can go see Revolt, She Said,
Revolt Again.
And catch up with Third Rail Rep.
And now I got to talk with Jerry Mowawad and Carol Triffel from Imago Theater. They're talking about their new work, La Belle, Lost in the World of the Automaton. It runs April 6th through the 29th.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Adventures in Artslandia. I am sitting with Jerry Mowawad and Carol Triffel of Imago Theater. We are so lucky to have you guys today to talk a little bit about La Belle that is opening pretty quick here.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about it.
La Belle started with the concept of, I don't know, how did it start? it started with the concept of doing a piece based on La Bella La Bette, the original
AKA
novel.
AKA The Beauty and the Beast.
Yes. So we went back to the original novel, read it, and we started to work with a couple of composers and another writer. And then after a year, we threw out the script because it was not really Imago-esque. It was a little bit more monumental and a big cast. On a drive to visit our daughter in Reno, Carol and I came up with a concept and an outline, which was that the story of La Belle et la Bête will be told by a man that lives in the steam room, the engine room of a steamship. Mm-hmm. And he has been there, we don't know, many years, and he has built the story of La Belle et la Bête with automaton, little figurines that move to that move like clockwork mechanics.
Mm.
Then we came back and we spent a week with our co-writer, Devin Stinson, to flush out the outline. And basically, it turned into a story of a woman who is vacationing on the steamship that had to escape from a storm that's going on, and she ends up in the steam room, and at first she's a little scared because it's a scary, dark place, and she discovers one of the automaton, and then she falls in love with the automaton, and eventually they both start to tell the story of La Belle et la Bête unwrapping for the audience, really, all these thousands of little effects that we created, and then they start to parallel Beauty and the Beast themselves.
I love that. That's what I thought immediately, mm-hmm. an automaton and a human, and, mm-hmm. wow, that's beautiful. What a beautiful way illuminate the piece.
The piece is quite beautiful in terms of its design work, and it's kind of like a little music box in that it's both a theater piece and kind of an enchantment as well.
And who designed a lot of the effects, and are you using puppetry as well?
Yeah, we're using a lot of puppetry. Carol and I designed everything, and then we worked with many different artisans.
To fabricate mm-hmm. everything. Wow.
Yeah, we worked for about 2.5 years with about 10 to 15 different artists.
It's really incredible because I find it incredibly inspirational the way you work in your employment of individual artists. You have a vision, and then you bring to the table artists who can help you bring that vision to fruition on stage. And to use that many actual artists, it's unusual, you know, in fabricating these types of big effects.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about it? Yeah. I've been talking the most.
Well, Imago has always used artists for the talent that they can give us. And also that their specialty is. And then the actor actors on stage are really good at clown work as well as singing, dancing, mm-hmm. and acting. Mm-hmm. So in that way, they've given us things that they don't have the chance to give other theaters mm-hmm. as much, and because it crosses the all boundaries in theater. Mm-hmm. And then as far as the all the technical parts of the fabrication, we worked with crafts. They wouldn't say they're crafts people because they're much more than that. They were in themselves designers and worked on their own shows and other people's shows. And so, you know, whether Jerry or I designed something and they actually brought it to the end on stage, we couldn't have done it without them. Their expertise was incredible.
So it's like a real collaboration.
In that way. There was things that we'd say, you know, it was like we were lucky to have those people where we could say, well, we want this wheel behind the set to come illuminate during shadow scenes and to be able to move at variable speed mm-hmm. and then turn on and off mm-hmm. and go backwards and forwards mm-hmm. and then move out of the way. Mm-hmm. And we found a person that they were a mechanical engineer and they volunteered their time for a really long time.
Wow.
And then we ended up paying them too. Uh-huh. But he was retired and he did all of that and it turned out to be really
You should incredible. Mention his name. His name was Roger Nelson, and unfortunately he died during the build of the show.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, so he dedicated the production, the opening mm-hmm. run to him. Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
Yes.
And he won an award, too, posthumously. Is that a word?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's so interesting because creative expression is such an important part of life here in the mm-hmm. world. And the opportunities you give people to create with you mm-hmm. is so life-affirming. Mm-hmm. And you really, you put a lot of people to work, you know, to kind of join on your vision, which mm-hmm. is always, it's exciting and inspirational, I think. Mm-hmm.
I don't know what other productions in town have gone to that extent. There's mm-hmm. probably a few, but mm-hmm. I don't know that many spent 3 years in development.
Right, and then to bring actors and singer, you know, expert performers into the mix after the fact. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of minds at work.
Yeah, and all the songs are original. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we worked with composers as well as we wrote lyrics. Mm-hmm. And so they it wasn't like they could come in and do a musical because it was an original mm-hmm. semi-musical. So there's quite a few songs in it, but it's you know, they're very short. And so they pretty much propel the story and bring it to another level to show you that, you know, it just makes you flip inside of the two parallel stories, or, you know, the Beauty and the Beast story, and then all of a sudden you're flipped back into the couple's love story, and the songs can propel you into those two different spaces.
Mm. Also, to kind of entice listeners to come, did win a special PAMTA award because it didn't really fit into a musical theater category, mm-hmm. and then it won several Drammy Awards as well. Mm-hmm. Also want to say that there are four performers in the show. There's Lance Woolen and Aaron Chimella.
I love Lance Woolen.
Yeah, he's great.
He's great.
Lance was the director of fabrication on the whole project. Mm-hmm. And then there's Jim Vidala and Justine Davis, who play Sam Stoker and Lady Rose. Mm-hmm. So they're all the only ones visible in the show. Mm-hmm. And then Lance and Aaron are operating a puppetry, sometimes making the audience think that something is an automaton when it's actually puppetry going on. Mm. But we discovered in the process that creating an automaton and creating a fake automaton are equally difficult.
Oh, that's interesting. So
making something look like an automaton is just as hard as making the automaton.
When you're on your trip to Reno and you're going to visit your daughter and you guys are hashing out, well, what if this? What if that? What if this? And now here you're at the end of the process in a performance, mm-hmm. almost to performing. How do you feel your vision was realized? And are there things that you really weren't thinking were going to turn out a certain way that did, or has it come?
Well, it was a big learning curve because Carol and I always believed in throwing out rules of theater. I think we're known in town for that. Mm-hmm. And This one, we were creating a family work that I also have to say that it's really, when we created it, we said, let's not create a show for kids that adults can come to. Let's create a show for adults that kids can come to, mm-hmm. which is quite a different approach to the whole piece. Mm-hmm. And I lost my train of thought. Would you ask?
No, it's all right. When you came out to the first, when you decided what you were going to do, and now here you've done it, you know, how does it feel to be
I know what I was going to say. When we created Frogs and Zuzu and those mass theater works, we learned, it took a long time to learn, but we learned two basic things in that show, don't be careful of narrative, because narrative weighs down mass theater, comedy, it weighs it down and it starts you to focus on story. And that's not where the focus of those shows was. The other was, if it's too complex, most likely it won't work. Now, when we entered La Belle, we didn't intend to, but both of those concepts were thrown out the door. It's very complicated.
Oh, right.
And what was the other one?
And narrative.
Oh, and it's highly narrative.
Well, yeah. But at the same time, it's a lot of fairy tale fantasy narrative.
Right.
So you really have to abandon yourself to get into it, so that you can say, oh, now we're in the ship with the couple that are discovering that they're in love, and discovering the story, discovering that they're like Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden the costumes magically change, and the set, things change, and then they are Beauty and the Beast.
Well, I love that, because often in the world, you know, we're reading stories and then we're comparing our own lives mm-hmm. to them, and especially in a grand philosophical type story like mm-hmm. Beauty and the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
So here you put it up close and personal, mm-hmm. you know, you have the stories happening simultaneously, I think would be really beautiful.
Yeah, and so we've always tried to find a way to get into the fairy tale world that would be something that all ages, adults as well as kids could enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when both of us were, you know, in our 20s, we saw Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast, and it's very dreamlike, and, you know, we couldn't do that story. It actually isn't even the story of Beauty and the Beast. Neither is ours.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a lot of parallels worlds in that there's fantastical creatures that can come alive, and in ours it's puppets.
And finding the beauty in mm-hmm. all things, mm-hmm. and our connection, and, human, mm-hmm. or not necessarily human, but just connection between beings.
There's small stories of love and, you know, passion and desire and, you know, and separation that everyone goes through when they're in love. and then there's a lot of stuff with that small details that kids really get into.
Mm.
So when there's a automaton that opens up magically, and Lady Rose actually climbs out of it, and it is full of puppets talking, you know, and you know, kids would just, like, they zoom in on that. Like, how did you do that? Where did she come from?
Mm.
How do those puppets go? And, you know, they get really excited about the color and just the shadows. And there's also shadow puppetry that kids really like. And,
mm-hmm.
and as well as us, you know, when you get older, it doesn't mean that you lose your child's soul.
No. Well, hopefully not. But no. It's nice to keep being reminded to touch back to
mm-hmm.
it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to find that delight in the magic
mm-hmm.
and lose the jaded thing.
Yeah, well, you definitely walk in the door and you lose it pretty quickly.
That's
great.
You
know, because the set is exposed right away, and you are looking at a world that is unique. It's like, you know, it's like the movie that just won all the Oscars, that world, that you know, underwater world, you totally fall into it.
Mm-hmm.
And this world, you fall into the ship's engine room.
Mm. How long did it take you to load in?
Oh, we got that down to a science now.
Wow.
Yeah, the first time we loaded in was 2.5 months. And then we did a load in that took a week. And then we hit the road, and I met with the cast and crew. We had prepped, and we go, okay, we did it 3 months, and then we did it in a week. Now we have to do it in 10 hours. So the whole show was designed to do that, and it was done. I was quite nervous about it, but we were able to pull off a national tour with 1 or 2 day load-ins.
Wow, what was that like? What cities did you visit?
In California, we played where?
Santa Rosa, Santa Barbara, all the UC campuses.
Oh, Berkeley. How lovely. Berkeley. Oh, that's mm-hmm. great.
On the East Coast, we played the Bronx and Long Island, Urbana, Illinois, and there was one more.
I forget.
No worries. Just, well, I know from traveling a little bit in my work, you know, you arrive, you get ready to perform, you do your thing. How did it go?
Well, probably Carol and I were the most nervous because the production is so complex.
Right.
And we've never, like I said, our shows that tour nationally are not complex.
Mm-hmm.
And they did fine.
Oh, that's
they
great.
They relaxed into it. And they were, everybody was prepared because Carol and I were, as producers, were preparing them for 6 months for the tour mm-hmm. in terms of systems, and that's all technical systems and breakdowns and how to get the setup. But it's pretty much it was a precision. LaBelle is complicated in every respect.
Mm-hmm.
It has like over 300 sound cues in it.
Mm-hmm. Are you running the sound?
No, Kyle Delamarta, one of our company members, mm-hmm. did the sound design, and he's running the sound.
Mm.
The lighting is quite intricate. There's some live music and, like I said, composed songs as well.
I meant to ask you, who was your predominant composer?
There were several.
It was a lot. Mm-hmm. Different.
Amanda and Alyssa Payne, who the best to classify their work in this show is trip hop. Then there was Lydia Oogley
mm-hmm.
from Los Angeles. That her work, you can kind of put it in like ragtime or something like that.
And so then, one more. Then Kyle Delamarte actually did one of the music songs.
Nice.
But we all did. I mean, Jerry, I, and the composers did all the lyrics.
Nice.
I didn't do any lyrics.
You helped.
Okay. I guess so.
He had edits.
So you can come see LaBelle, Lost in the World of the Automaton, April 6th through April 29th, and you can go to imagotheater.com to buy tickets and learn more.
Yeah, and you can also see a little trailer on the Imago website.
Sounds great. Well, thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for making work in the city. It's amazing.
Thank you.
Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive. Good time, having a good time.